Welcome. You are listening to Aftersight. This recording is intended solely for individuals who are blind or have low vision.
Thank you for joining us for the Saturday, December 11th reading of the following publications from the Arvada Press. Apex opens state-of-the-art archery range at Apex Center. Council approves additional $2 million for 72nd Avenue Consultant by Riley Dunn. Car crashes through Arvada liquor store, leaves person injured by Riley Dunn. From the Canyon Courier, tiny insect poses huge threat in foothills by Jane Reuter. And from the Jeffco Transcript, October asbestos spill shutters Lakewood Library admin offices by Susie Glassman. Colorado Gives Foundation celebrates 50 years of giving by Lillian Fugley. Enrollment in Jeffco falls to historic low by Susie Glassman. U.S. 285 and Kings Valley Interchange Project Shelved by Jane Reuter. Mountain Firefighters React to Demise of Merger Effort by Jane Reuter. Apex opens state-of-the-art archery range at Apex Center. Apex Archery Range designed to be utilized by archers of all ages and skill levels by Riley Dunn. Archers in Arvada will have a new spot to practice their skills as the Apex Park and Recreation District is set to open the Apex Archery Range on December 12th. The range is located directly behind the Apex Center, which itself is located at 13150 West 72nd Avenue. The outdoor range is geared to archers of all ages and skill levels. Apex is planning to offer a mix of programming that is tailored to seasoned archers and beginners alike. There will also be drop-in archery offered at the range. Apex will have certified instructors on hand to help novices practice their skills safely. Monica Bowser, Apex's Community Services Manager, said that the district decided to build the archery range when it noticed there were few public venues for archers to practice. This project was built both with our community needs in mind and our core values, Bowser said. We were noticing around town that most nearby ranges are private. They have long wait lists and they don't offer equipment rentals for their indoor ranges. So we wanted something our community could access. We wanted to provide an environment where people can come and connect with others. They can challenge themselves and enjoy outdoor time and maybe learn a new sport, Bowser continued. The project was first brought up in 2019, though construction didn't start until much more recently. It cost about $40,000 to build. Vicky Pine, president of the Apex Board of Directors, said that archery offers a lot of transferable life skills that folks can utilize in other areas as well. This new amenity is a fantastic addition to our community, Pine said. Archery is a sport that promotes focus, discipline, and fun. And now, thanks to this dedicated space, it's more accessible than ever. We're thrilled to offer inclusive programming that supports all abilities and experience levels. Apex Recreation Coordinator Kelly Scott explained what the process will be for drop-in archery. You just come and check in and say that you haven't shot before and need the equipment, and you'll have a brief safety instruction, and myself or one of the other instructors will help you get up and running, Scott says. We'll also have the Try Archery class available, which is like 1 hour one time and you just want to try it out. You can come with your family or friends or on your own, but it's a good way to be introduced to it with safety, Scott continued. Drop-in archery is $7 for Apex residents, for $10 or $10 for non-residents, plus the cost of equipment rentals if needed. I think that it really is going to give a lot more people an opportunity to enjoy a sport that can be one that's not easy to get into as other ones are, Bowser said. Whether it's because you know where to go or you don't have the equipment, this really provides a good way for people to try it and see if they like it. More information about programming for the Apex Archery course can be found at apexprd.org. This article is included with a picture with the following caption: Archers try out the new Apex Archery range. This is a picture of two people, a man and a woman, and the man is wearing a green shirt, light green shirt, and dark green pants, and the woman is wearing a white t-shirt over a dark long sleeve shirt, and she also has on green pants, and they're both wearing something around their waist that is holding the arrows. They're both holding bows and aiming at targets that are probably maybe 50 feet away, and they're outdoors, and there's some wood slats that are built that are kind of at catty corner to the range, and there's some black flaps that are above the probably for protection of the bows going or the arrows going too high. Council approves additional $2 million for 72nd Avenue consultant. Work on the final phase of the delayed project is expected to start as soon as February. By Riley Dunn. Work on the 72nd Avenue bond project is set to resume as early as February, and Arvada City Council approved a $2 million contract with Ulteague Operations on December 2nd, who will serve as a consultant on the third and final phase of the project, which encompasses the thoroughfare from Oak Street to Kipling Parkway. The project will widen 72nd Avenue from 2 lanes to 4 lanes from Swadley Court to Kipling Parkway. The section between Swadley and Oak was completed in 2024, but negotiations with the Union Pacific Railroad about a planned underpass replacing the at-grade crossing at 72nd Avenue and Oak Street intersection has stalled the project until recently. Arvada's website says that the plan for the underpass has been approved in partnership with the railroad, and the city's director of infrastructure, Jacqueline Rhodes, said that the agreement would likely come before council in January for approval. Once approved, the project can move into its final phase. The estimated date of completion for the project will begin with a bond measure vote in 2018, which began with a bond measure vote in 2018 and saw construction begin in 2021, is not expected to be in sometime in 2029. At the December 2nd council meeting, Arvada's Director of Finance, Brian Archer, said that the project budget in 2019 was around $64.5 million, but that figure has ballooned to approximately $97.5 million as of late. That leaves us a gap of roughly, let's just use round numbers, $33 million, so we have a few ways that we're going to make that up, Archer said. When we issued our bond in 2019, we did not use our entire authority. We had an authority of $80 million. We only issued about $72 million. In 2023, City Council approved us issuing the difference. That was about $8 million, of which we used about $4.1 million to finish Ralston Road. We will take the remaining $3.9 million right now. We're estimating another $3 million, and that will gain in interest. And then finally, that will leave us again, round numbers, about $27 million short, Archer continued. What we've done is, as part of our 98101 funds, the CIP dollars that we take out of sales tax each year, we've reserved an amount to issue that $27 million in 2026 and pay for those. So new taxes, no additional dollars, but what we've done is carved out an amount that we feel comfortable that should be able to pay the debt. The $2 million allocated to OLTIG is already in the general fund and will not factor into the larger financial puzzle surrounding the project. Council member Michael Griffith asked if hiring a consultant was necessary. While we hire a consultant to help with the staff augmentation, that's something that we don't have the capacity for internally, Griffith said. Is that true in this case, that we just don't have the capacity to do that sort of consultation liaison role, owner's rep role between the contractor and the duty of the project? Rhodes said that it was needed and the scope of the project is outside of what city staff council members can solely take on. Yes, with this type of complex project, it does make sense to augment our staff with additional inspectors, additional support, Rhodes said. So this is common on some of our large, more complex CIPS that we take this approach and this model. The contract was approved by a 5-0 vote with council members Lauren Simpson and Bob Pfeiffer absent. This article is included with the photo with the following caption. The section of 72nd Avenue that has already been widened. And this is a photo of a long shot of a roadway. And the foreground is, it almost looks like a sidewalk next to the roadway. You can see the trees in the distance. It's kind of a perspective shot where it's full at the front part of the picture and it gets smaller at the back part of the picture. There's also, it looks like a red, it's an orange construction sign. There's a yellow fire hydrant. The sky is blue. The roadway is concrete. And it does look like there's a little bit of snow along the roadway as well. Car crashes through Arvada liquor store, leaves person injured. Drugs and alcohol are not suspected to be a factor in the crash, which injured two. By Riley Dunn. A car crashed through the Cornerstone liquor store and wine store located at 7355 Ralston Road in Arvada on December 3rd, sending two to the hospital. One with serious injuries, according to Arvada Public Police Information Officer Dave Snelling. Drugs and alcohol are not suspected to be a factor in the crash, Snelling said. The crash occurred around 2 p.m. on December 3rd, when a silver Subaru Outback drove over the sidewalk and into the front of the liquor store. The individual standing outside the liquor store was struck by the car and transported to the hospital, as was another individual who was inside the store and sustained more minor injuries, according to Snelling. The driver was just driving down that section and went to turn into the spot and just kept going, Snelling said. Snelling said that the ice and snow on the roads on December 3rd were not a factor in the crash. He added that officers interviewed the driver, who was alone in the car, and they do not believe they were under the influence of substances. This article is accompanied by a photo with the following caption, "The car that crashed through the liquor store in Arvada." And this is a picture of Cornerstone Liquors. It's a red sign. Cornerstone is in red and Liquors is in big white letters. And there is it's a brick store with windows in the storefront. And you can see the empty parking spaces in the front of the store. And there is a car halfway through the windows. And there are parking blocks that it looks like the car must have gone over them because the car is on the other side of the parking blocks. It does look like there's a little bit of snow and the pavement is wet. It is a overcast day and in the windows there are lots of pictures of things. It looks like there's a Coors beer can and a red sign and a black sign with some writing. I can't tell what they are. From the Canyon Courier, tiny insect poses huge threat in foothills. More than 200 people turn out to learn how to stem the mountain pine beetle epidemic by Jane Reuter. An insect the size of a grain of rice drew a standing room-only crowd and filled the parking lot at West Jefferson Middle School. More than 200 people showed up for the November Conifer Area Council meeting, which focused on the recent pine beetle infestation. Damage done by beetles to mountain trees amplifies fire danger in an area that already ranks number one nationally for wildfire risk. Experts in several areas talked about the pine beetle, how each agency is attacking the issue, and ways local residents can participate in the battle. We're in the third of fourth year of a breakout of pine beetle affecting the Front Range, said Alicia Doran, Jeffco's invasive species coordinator. We've identified over 575 unique sites that have it. Mountain pine beetles are a native species. When forests are mostly healthy, they benefit them by attacking and killing diseased and dying pine trees. That clears the way for healthy young trees to thrive. But when forests are dense, unhealthy, and stressed by uncontrolled growth, drought, and warm temperatures, the beetle's population explodes to their current epidemic levels. A devastating decade-plus outbreak occurred from the late 1990s through 2013 when the beetles affected 3.4 million acres of forests in Colorado, most of them lodgepole pines. They killed nearly 90% of trees in some lodgepole pine forests in Summit, Grand, Eagle, and Rout counties. In the early 2010s, mountain pine beetles began transitioning into Front Range ponderosa pine forests. Heavy rains and flooding ended that epidemic, but left ponderosa pine forests vulnerable to future bark beetle infestations. In recent years, rapidly changing precipitation and warm temperatures have made pine forests that largely escaped the prior pandemic susceptible to mountain pine beetle outbreaks. County efforts are slow. Jefferson County is taking action on its land, but progress is slow, said Tony Achuelo, Jeffco's natural resources team lead. The team includes just 5 people with 2 seasonal employees. The work is difficult and time-consuming. County workers chip and peel wood and use a masticator, a heavy machine with a rotary cutter head that grinds and chips trees and brush into small pieces. The problem with all these things we're doing is scale and access, he says. We're able to do about 24 acres of concentrated pine beetle work and about 800 hours of the log wizarding that various parks this year. It is very physically demanding and causes a lot of repetitive stress injuries. While those methods kill the beetle, preventing it from spreading is a much better and less laborious process. To that end, the county is also focused on managing slash and putting pheromone packets on trees, which replicate the beetle pheromone and tells it that the tree is full and the food supply insufficient for additional beetles. Trees emit a different kind of pheromone when they're unhealthy. The beetles are attracted to stress pheromones, Achuelo said. They can smell when the trees are sick. All of our trees are sick. Our forests are unnaturally overcrowded. The most important thing we're doing, though, is creating those healthy forests through mitigation, he said. If you care about beetles, fire, and wildlife, do thinning. Control methods and timing. Treating trees to prevent the beetle from maturing is key, and the timing for each treatment is different. Understanding the insect's life cycle is also critical. At this time of year, females and males have already infested the trees and mated under the bark. eggs have been laid and hatched, and the larva found feed under the bark throughout the winter and spring. Infected trees can be identified from the exterior by the presence of popcorn-like pitch tubes or reddish-brown boring dust on the trunk and around the base. Under the bark, there may be blue staining and horizontal larval galleries, narrow horizontal tunnels by the beetle's larvae as they feed. The horizontal galleries prevent food and water from moving through the trunk, killing the tree. Larvae may also be in the galleries. They are small white grubs with a dark hardened heads. All the recommended methods for stopping the larvae from becoming adults first involve cutting green trees that contain live stages of the beetle. According to Alicia Doran, Jeffco Invasive Species Management Coordinator, solar methods include removing and scattering limbs, cutting the trunk into 4 to 6 foot lengths, stacking logs in a single layer, exposed to a full day's sun, and rotating them every 30 days to heat both sides. Another method adds a cover of plastic to the solar method. After stacking them in a single layer, she suggested wetting the logs, covering them with a thick layer of clear plastic, digging a trench and burying the edge of the plastic tarp with soil. The plastic should stay on at least 3 months. The larva can be also killed by debarking. This time of year is a great time to be out looking for beetles, Duran said. We recommend you start early. We recommend if you're using a contractor, you'll get on their schedule because they're filling up quickly. For more information on controlling mountain pine beetles at various stages of their lives, visit Jeffco's webpage on treatment options. Jeffco's Wildland Fire Program Manager, Brian Keating, said the best defense against both the beetles and the wildland fire is mitigation. As this beetle epidemic proceeds over time, we're going to have elevated fire risk, he said. Do a home wildfire assessment and create defensible space. Elk Creek Fire offers a home assessment program for the residents of Elk Creek and Conifer Fire Protection Districts. For a $100 fee, they can request a professional evaluation of the exterior of their home and surrounding property to determine their susceptibility to wildfire, steps to make their home more defensible. Enrollment in Jeffco falls to historic low. District records smallest kindergarten class ever as young families move out, by Susie Glassman. Jefferson County Public Schools enrollment has dropped to its lowest point in years, with this year's kindergarten class the smallest in district history, according to a presentation by Chief Financial Officer Brenna Copeland and Executive Director of Finance Shannon Rosario to the school board on November 13th. The district now serves 74,227 students, down 1,281 from last year, a 1.7% decline. District-managed schools, which don't include charter schools, saw an even steeper 2.3% drop, losing about 1,500 students. In Colorado, the year 2007 was the peak birth year. State demographer Nancy Gideon said, there were more babies born in Colorado in 2007 than any prior year or any year since. Those kids just graduated. The year's kindergarten count of 4,092, down 4.4%, marks the lowest in Jeffco history. That is a statistic that we find particularly concerning, Copeland said. Fewer kindergartners mean smaller classes moving through the system, with less state funding following each shrinking cohort. For families, this is why your child's school might look different in 3 years. Fewer students means less money, which means fewer teachers, consolidated programs, or closed buildings. The culprit isn't families choosing other schools, it's families leaving entirely. We lost 12.8% of our under 5-year-olds in 3 years, Rosario said. It's not that they're going to a charter school or a public school. They're moving out of Jefferson County. Why families are leaving. Rosario pointed to soaring housing costs as a likely factor pushing young families out of Jefferson County. Home values in the county have jumped 76% since 2015, according to the U.S. Census data presented at the meeting. Gideon said rising costs definitely could play a role, though her office hasn't studied the link directly. But Jefferson County's challenges run deeper than statewide patterns. Gideon noted that Jeffco developed earlier than neighboring counties, seeing its housing boom in the 1970s compared to Douglas County's 1990s growth. Jeffco's school-age population peaked around 2000, years before the rest of Colorado. The result is that the district is losing children before they ever start school. A decade ago, about 91% of children born within the district boundary eventually enrolled in Jeffco kindergarten. This year, that figure fell to 75%. While the comparison involves different cohorts rather than tracking the same children, Rosario said it signals a leaky pipeline, which families leaving between birth and school age. The district also saw an unexpected 55% drop in newcomer students from 879 last October to just 400 this year. This was unanticipated as part of our forecast, Rosario said. Gideon noted international migration to Colorado has swung wildly in recent years and is based on federal policy, which we in Colorado cannot control. The enrollment decline would have cost the district about $4 million in state funding. However, a hold harmless provision, a state rule that temporarily cushions funding drops, limited the actual loss to roughly $1 million, or about what it costs to employ 10 teachers for a year. Regional differences. Board members cautioned against reading too much into county-wide averages. We're a pretty large county geographically, said board member Aaron Kenworthy. Even though this looks steady, it doesn't mean that articulation areas and school boundaries are going to hold steady. Articulation areas are feeder patterns connecting elementary schools to their corresponding middle and high schools. The Northeast region, covering Arvada, Pomona, and Stanley Lake, experienced the steepest decline at 4.6%. Board member Danielle Varda noted that roughly 40% of the district's 18 charter schools are concentrated there, which may help. Line. Elementary schools have been hit hardest, losing more than 6,200 students, a 19% drop since 2016-2017. That number is still a bit eye-popping for me, Copeland said. Births in the district rise 4.3% last year, offering some hope for the future. But Copeland cautioned the uptick may be an anomaly. Demographers project the school-aged population will continue declining gradually until about 2040. The enrollment data lands as the district prepares to cut about $45 million from its budget. Final reduction plans will be published December 18th, with approximately 150 to 160 employees expected to receive position elimination notices December 15th to 17th. A committee will form in January to develop potential 2026 ballot measure. The district currently receives $2,120 per student in mill levy override funding. The extra local tax dollars voters approve on top of state funding, compared to $3,407 in Denver, $3,115 in Boulder, and $3,004 in Cherry Creek. What to watch for at your school? Parents can watch for signs at the school level, including growing class sizes, program cuts, and combined grade classrooms. Schools running well below capacity may face harder choices. The district publishes school-by-school data on its FCB dashboard. School-level staffing decisions typically happen in the spring. Asked about districts like Jeffco, Gideon was candid. When I do talk to school planners, I often tell them, I don't envy your position, she said. And this photo is this US 285 and Kings Valley Interchange project shelved. State says rising costs, lack of funding, will suspend work until money is secured. By Jane Reuter. Reconstruction of the U.S. Highway 285 and Kings Valley Drive intersection is on hold indefinitely, according to the Colorado Department of Transportation. Unfortunately, this is not funded, CDOT resident engineer Tom DiNardo said at the November Conifer Area Council meeting. Right now, we're just shelving this project. Designs to build a grade-separated overpass were underway in 2021 with the expectation of completing the $14 million project by early 2024. By 2022, the expected cost had increased to $35 million. Today, the total cost is estimated to $77 million. The main issue is the cost of this interchange is very excessive right now. He said, we have to rely on federal grants to accomplish this, and we don't have that much money right now. This has kind of been a black eye for CDOT. We made a lot of promises to the community we haven't been able to fulfill. Dangerous intersection. CDOT hasn't given up on the plans and is actively pursuing construction funding avenues and plans to build the interchange once it does. But even then, it will be a minimum of 3 years before the project is done, according to its website. Once the agency has the money for construction, it will resume the design and right-of-way purchases within, which will take 12 to 18 months. After that, the estimated 2-year construction project can begin. For local drivers, the concern is more about the intersection's danger than unfulfilled promises. The intersection is not only the entrance to a neighborhood, but home to a busy shopping center with a cafe, a liquor store, a gas station, and an exercise studio, among other businesses. Marilyn Saltzman, a 45-year Kings Valley resident who drives through the intersection daily, alerted CDOT to the need for improvements to the intersection with a neighborhood petition drive in 2020. We wrote letters to the governor and CDOT, and we got their attention, she said. That's when they first started looking into it. It's disappointing because it's dangerous and I have 2 grandchildren driving now. But I understand it's just not feasible that the price tag with no money available. I'm hoping they'll come up with some alternatives. She described the interchange as especially dangerous and said she's seen a lot of near misses when people are trying to make a left turn into Kings Valley and others are trying to make a left turn onto 285. When there's heavy traffic in the summer and during leaf peeping season, making a left turn out of Kings Valley can take a very long time, she said. People get impatient and maybe take chances they shouldn't. DiNardo said the agency is looking at interim improvements, but he did not offer details, only saying the ideas are very preliminary. We're in the brainstorming process, figuring out what we can do to improve safety while noting the funding constraints, he said. And this article is accompanied by a photo with the following caption. The new design for US 285 in Kings Valley Interchange was presented in 2021 And this is a rendering of a picture from the air of a interchange, and it has diagonally going the 285 going diagonally across the photo with lots of green grass and trees in the rest of the photo, and you can see the interchange. There are probably about 20 cars in the rendering. There's also a picture with the following caption: Kings Valley Marketplace, located at the intersection of Kings Valley Drive and US 285, draws significant traffic. The intersection is also the access to a neighborhood. And this is a picture of a building. It looks like it's about two, maybe three stories. There's a car out front, and you can also see a flagpole out front. The building has about five columns, and it's gray with white and red accents. There is a kind of a keystone looking window. It is a blue sky with a little white puffy cloud type of day. Mountain firefighters react to demise of merger effort. Plan would have combined three mountain agencies but face legal battle, by Jane Reuter. Conifer Fire's chief, Elk Creek firefighters, say they're disappointed but moving forward after the recent news that the Elk Creek Fire Protection District will no longer pursue unification. Had the proposal moved forward, Elk Creek would have joined Conifer Fire, which includes the former North Fork and Inner Canyon Fire Districts. Those two agencies merged in January 2025 without their third partner. Elk Creek's effort to unify with its neighboring districts were thwarted when an Elk Creek board member and district resident filed an appeal against it. After a year of legal wrangling, the other members of the Elk Creek Fire Board walked away from November 21 from the unification effort, citing escalating legal costs in a battle that threatened to go on for years. "Obviously, we're disappointed," said Conifer Fire Chief Kurt Rogers. We really believe it's best for the citizens of all the districts to operate as one agency. But we totally understand. You have to evaluate what's best for the taxpayers in your district and for Elk Creek. Bearing those legal costs to push this forward were significant. We'll try to work with Elk Creek in the future as we can, but we have to start moving ahead with Conifer Fire as well. North Fork and Inyan Inter Canyon Fire District used the same Colorado statute to unify that Elk Creek followed, but their effort was not opposed. Rogers said he doesn't believe anyone will challenge it. "I don't have a fear about that," he said. "I think there's a time limit on how long you can contest these things." Several districts have been born this way, and no one has made a ruling this was an illegal way to form districts. "It's unfortunate two people interfered with the ability to form one district, and I think Elk Creek could have still prevailed. But you have to weigh that against time and money." Arvada Fire, South Metro Fire, and others used to have Title 32, the statute used by North Ford and Inner Canyon, and that Elk Creek tied to use to bring several other agencies under their banner in the last few years. Rogers sees more such consolidations coming from fire agencies, citing the decline in volunteerism and other issues. "These will continue to be a concern to the future," he said. "If you can erase those borders and put resources where you need them, that's better for everybody." The former North Fork and Inter Canyon districts have already merged their administrative duties. Conifer Fire will soon begin remodeling Inter Canyon Station 3 at 8445 US 285, converting the building designed only for equipment, training, and volunteer responses into one in which paid firefighters can live during their shifts. The one bathroom building among eight stations with Conifer Fire will be reconstructed to include 2 bathrooms and 3 bedrooms. In 2027, Rogers expects to hire staff for the remodeled station. He said the merger has been good for firefighters and taxpayers. Folding our administrative functions together is a benefit to all citizens, he said. You don't have to pay for 2 insurance policies, 2 legal bills. We can also now move people around more easily. If we know one side of the district is a little shorter staffed, we can move people to help with that. Elk Creek Firefighters respond. Elk Creek Firefighters Union Local 4710 issued a statement about the end of the unification era effort. We support the district's recent decision to end costly litigation and refocus those resources on public safety, the statement read. If we feel any disappointment, it is that the ongoing legal battles have slowed progress toward improving service levels, staffing, and coordination for the residents we serve. Our commitment has always been to building a stronger, more effective system of fire and emergency services for the community. The statement said Elk Creek Firefighters will continue their work to protect the community. As always, Local 4710 will lead with integrity, professionalism, and an unwavering commitment to the residents who depend on us, it read. And this is accompanied by a photo with the following caption. In August 2024, photo of the Intercanyon Chief Ship Sherlaw, North Fork Chief Rogers, and Elk Creek Chief Jacob Weir. Intercanyon North Fork have since merged. Rogers is Conifer Fire Chief and Sherlaw is its Deputy Chief. This is a photo of 3 men standing in front of a red truck. It looks like a pickup truck. These men are in their 40s and 50s. They're all white men, and they're wearing a blue, two of them are wearing blue short sleeve, one of them wearing long sleeve, and it looks like a fire chief uniform, and they have badges on the left chest. And let's see, two of them have mustaches and brown hair, and one of them has white hair, and it looks like no mustache. They're outside, and it looks like blue sky with some white puffy clouds. October asbestos spill shutters Lakewood Library admin offices. Uncertified workers spread contamination through hallways and into dumpster, by Susie Glassman. Workers who weren't trained to handle asbestos removed asbestos-containing flooring at Lakewood Library in early October, triggering a major contamination event that has kept the building's administrative offices closed for 2 months, according to state environmental records. The library has not said how many employees may have been exposed to asbestos, a known carcinogen linked to lung cancer and mesothelioma. JCPL says it is offering workers' compensation resources to staff who entered the contaminated area. Crews had to destroy employees' personal belongings. The removal, which certified asbestos abatement workers should have handled, spread contamination from the bathrooms, through hallways, and into a dumpster outside. State records show the cleanup has expanded more than sixfold since the October 2 spill, growing from a 400-square-foot bathroom renovation to more than 2,600 square feet of abatement work scheduled through mid-December. How it happened. Jefferson County Public Library hired TCC Corporation to renovate restrooms in the administrative wing at 10200 West 20th Avenue. The building also contains the Lakewood branch, though the public library areas were not contaminated. An inspection before the project found asbestos in the vinyl flooring. The library required TCC Corp to hire a licensed asbestos removal company, but the state records show the certified contractor didn't remove the flooring. A permit notification filed with the Colorado Department of Public Health and Environment on October 3rd, the day after the spill, states that the sheet vinyl flooring was removed from the scope of work and was not removed by AmeriForce. AmeriForce Environmental Incorporated was the certified asbestos abatement contractor on the project. The major asbestos spill notification filed with the state lists Logan Koch of TCC Corporation as the facility contact. The form describes more than 180 square feet of vinyl flooring removed, with contamination spreading from the bathrooms toward the center of the building and throughout the hallway, and material found in the dumpster of the southeast of the building. TCC Corporation did not respond to a request for comment. State response. CDPHE received notification of the spill on Friday, October 3rd, and informed library staff that they must restrict access to the contaminated area. JCPL said it closed the building October 2nd, as soon as the potential for contamination was identified. After the spill occurred, library staff reached out to CDPHE for guidance and followed state protocol by contacting the appropriate certified professionals to respond to the incident, the department said. On October 6, CDPHE received an application from AmeriForce to begin cleaning up exterior areas around the dumpster. The division has since issued additional permits for interior cleanup, but the department has no authority to speed up the work. State law does not let the health department force building owners to finish asbestos cleanup by a certain date, CDPHE said. Expanding cleanup. The original renovation called for 400 square feet of drywall removal in the bathrooms. After the spill, state permits show the project grew to include exterior cleanup of contaminated concrete and the dumpster interior spill response across hallways, offices, closets, printer rooms, and ceiling spaces, and an additional 1,800 square feet of mastic removal. A November 19th permit modification puts the total at 2,601 square feet. State records describe the Phase 3 interior work as responding to a major spill. Contractors have pushed the project's end date back six times from the original October 2 to December 12. CDPHE upgraded the permit from 30-day to 90-day on November 6. Costs and accountability. The library is still calculating the full cost of cleanup. The library says it expects contractors on their insurers to be financially responsible for the cleanup and other costs. As the asbestos spill occurred as a result of TCC's work, they are overseeing the asbestos spill response to their subcontracted abatement contractor, Pennington said. Limited public discourse. A notice posted on the building's door says only, "Due to construction, we have had to close the building today. It makes no mention of asbestos." JCPL said it notified affected patrons via email and provided talking points to staff, but as of Monday, the library's website mentions only restroom renovations with no reference to asbestos. The incident comes as the library system faces separate scrutiny over stalled labor negotiations. Workers packed a November 20th board meeting at the same Lakewood Library building to protest wages that they say haven't kept pace with inflation. The library's public areas were not contaminated, according to JCPL. Testing confirmed asbestos contamination did not spread beyond the administrative wing. There is no firm reopening date. JCPL said it expects to reopen after the new year. Clearance testing has been completed, and restoration work must take place before the administrative offices can reopen. For health concerns related to potential asbestos exposure, CDPHE encourages people to contact their health care providers. This article is included with the following picture with the following caption. State records show the cleanup has expanded more than sixfold since the October 2 spill, growing from a 400 square foot bathroom renovation to more than 2,600 square feet of abatement work scheduled through mid-December. And this is a photo of the outside of the library, and it shows a sign that says Library Administration. The library is a mirrored building, and you can see the sign is purple or pinkish and orange, and there's blue sky, a little bit of grass, a sidewalk, and a reflection of the building across the way in the picture. Colorado Gives Foundation celebrates 50 years of giving. Foundation's annual fundraiser offers an easy way to donate to nonprofits throughout Colorado. By Lillian Fuglay. As the holiday season is gearing up and people are shopping online for gifts, the Colorado Gives Foundation is offering a different kind of online shopping, charitable donations. While the Colorado Gives Foundation's annual fundraiser, Colorado Gives Day, happened on December 10th, the foundation remains open with opportunities to donate to nonprofits any day of the year. Donations can easily be made to nonprofits throughout Colorado on the foundation's website, offering a convenient way for people to donate and for nonprofits to get funded. The foundation, which began in 1975, helps to support nonprofit organizations throughout Colorado, giving donors an easy way to connect with nonprofits on Colorado Gives Days. We're a community foundation, and foundation president and CEO Kelly Duncan, and we have a mission to connect people and nonprofits to make good happen. The foundation has its roots in Jefferson County, evolving out of the Lutheran Medical Center Foundation. Originally, the fundraising arm of the hospital, the foundation, has evolved over the last 50 years, becoming a standalone community foundation. Despite its separation from the hospital, the foundation maintains a presence in Jefferson County, offering grants throughout the year to nonprofits in Jefferson County. Each quarter, the foundation has an open grant opportunity focused on a different topic, giving nonprofits in Jefferson County a chance to apply for grants. Next year, the topics will include health, housing, and creating connected or convenient neighborhoods, supporting physical infrastructure that makes it easier for people to connect with each other. The opportunities are open to any nonprofit organization in Jefferson County to help grow the county and honor the foundation's roots. While the foundation has a strong presence in Jefferson County, it does work with nonprofits across the state as well. Their primary way of supporting groups throughout the state is Colorado Gives Day, a focused day of charitable giving. Colorado Gives Day began 16 years ago in 2010. As the internet was beginning to evolve and online shopping emerged, the foundation realized that charitable giving could be done online too, but that the websites to do so may be expensive and difficult to maintain, especially in the early days of the internet. So the foundation created its website as a way to bridge the gap, giving donors a platform to give a plethora of Colorado nonprofits. According to Duncan, when Colorado Gives Day launched, Colorado was one of the least charitable states per capita. Now, Colorado is sixth in the nation, a shift Duncan doesn't entirely attribute to Colorado Gives Day, but is happy to be a part of. On Colorado Gives Day, donors can visit the foundation's website and find the nonprofits that they want to give to, adding them to a shopping cart and choosing how much to donate to each organization. Donors can add as many as they want, and they can check out in one transaction with a variety of methods of payment, making it easy to give to as many nonprofits as the donor wants at once. If you don't know who you want to give to, you can search by subject area, Duncan said. Then, if you want to get hyperlocal, you can filter it by zip code to find nonprofits in your area who are focused on the issues that you care about. The day is a concentrated celebration of giving. There are power hours where nonprofits compete for prizes, seeing who can get the most donations in that hour. People who donate over $100 can even be entered in the drawing to win a free Southwest Airline ticket as well, giving nonprofits and donors the chance to win. The foundation also boosts donations given on Colorado Gives Day with its incentive fund, ensuring that nonprofits get even more funding. While donors can choose their favorite cause to contribute to, Duncan said the foundation had seen trends in which organizations got more contributions leading up to Colorado Gives Day. I think with the government shutdown, there was a lot of attention on people who are going to lose their SNAP benefits and were going to be unable to feed themselves and their family, Duncan said. So we've seen the food security organizations, those entities, food banks, food pantries, seem to be raising the most money now, followed in second place by arts and culture, and then education. Now, that could all change tomorrow, but that's what we've seen so far. The foundation offers other support for nonprofits and donors throughout the year, such as donor-advised funds. The funds, which started around $5,000, will allow the foundation to help connect the donor with causes they are passionate about. They also help nonprofits with nonprofit endowments, helping the organizations manage their money and make investments, as well as contributing to the endowment. Although Colorado Gives Day is the foundation's biggest fundraising day and the biggest fundraising day for many of the nonprofits it supports, the foundation's website remains active for donors to give to the nonprofits they like throughout the year. Donors can even set up recurring monthly donation, which the foundation will match for the month of December. According to Duncan, since Colorado Gives Day started, the foundation has raised $424 million for Colorado nonprofits, with over 700,000 donors participating and over 4,000 nonprofits benefiting. Duncan added that the day is deeply impactful for many nonprofits. We hear from nonprofits all the time that, for them, the value of Colorado Gives Day is that for some nonprofits, it's their biggest fundraising event of the year, Duncan said. They raise the majority of their budget on Colorado Gives Day, and it allows them to keep doing the work they do, whether that's providing early care and education for young kids, or running a shelter to get animals their forever homes, or even a school PTA raising money for students to participate in activities. Duncan added that for some nonprofits, the day puts them back in touch with donors they haven't heard from in a while, building that relationship back up. While the foundation offers one concentrated day of giving, their efforts and opportunities for support are year-round, helping nonprofits and donors alike. From donors, what we hear is it makes them feel like they're a part of something bigger than themselves, Duncan said. They're part of this statewide movement of making good happen. I think of it as like the ultimate feel-good day when we all get to contribute to our community. This article is accompanied by a photo with the following caption. The Colorado Gives Foundation offers many opportunities throughout the year to support Colorado nonprofits, including Colorado Gives Day. And this is a picture of about six children. They look like they're about 6 years old, and they're looking over a very large-sized check. And it says Hope House, I think. And it looks like it's made out for $60,000. And the children are looking at it. It's one of those large, larger-than-life-size checks. Thank you for joining us for the Saturday, December 11th, 2025 reading of the Jefferson County Publications. My name is Donna Gill.
If you enjoyed this program, please register for our free services at www.aftersight.org or by calling 303- 786-7777.